From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are journalist Nancy Marshall Genzer, senior reporter for Marketplace, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive producer. Welcome, Nancy and Steve.
Hello, Kim.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, here are the issues. In his first appearance as head of state at the United Nations General Assembly, President Joe Biden faced the challenge of convincing his global audience that America's commitment to multilateralism will endure while persuading his domestic audience that the United Nations is up to the task of addressing unprecedented global crises and challenges. In Washington, Democrats in control of Congress and the White House face a self-imposed September 27th deadline to pass a bipartisan infrastructure deal, as well as a threat of the government shutting down at the end of the month and raising the nation's borrowing limit in the coming weeks. Many Haitian migrants camped in a small Texas border town are being released in the United States, as told by two U.S. officials, undercutting the Biden administration's public statements that the thousands in the camp faced immediate expulsion. In Afghanistan, the Taliban rejected as baseless propaganda American concerns that Al-Qaeda or militants linked to the Middle East-based Islamic State terrorist group maintain a presence in the country. A spokesman for the Taliban made the assertion just days after the Islamic State's regional affiliate, or ISIS-K, claimed responsibility for a string of deadly bomb attacks targeting Taliban fighters in eastern Nangarhar province. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Nancy, at the UN General Assembly, President Biden used his first speech there as president to rally nations behind confronting common threats, explicitly tying the recent U.S. exit from Afghanistan to a broader shift from traditional military conflict to more intense U.S. diplomacy. How are the allies of the U.S. reacting to this shift of a broader focus?
Well, I think that they are going to be watching to see if President Biden walks the walk. I think that Europe has felt sort of neglected by this pivot to Asia. And we had France recalling its ambassador from the U.S. because a deal that it had with Australia was canceled when Australia decided it would buy nuclear-armed submarines from the U.S. instead of buying non-nuclear subs from France. So I think it was met with a bit of skepticism, a bit of a wait-and-see attitude.
Nancy's got a point that European allies have seen 4 years of an America First policy out of Donald Trump and are looking and waiting for various different signals from Joe Biden that the United States is back into the global game. And it is kind of a wait and see kind of attitude, especially with America's allies. Lots of ways to view Biden's first speech to the UNGA. I look at it as he addressed the three C's, climate, COVID, and China. Without even mentioning the word China, much of his speech was laden with references to the competition, talking about freedom of navigation, ensuring that basic labor rights and environmental safeguards are protected, along with intellectual property. He mentioned the issue with the Uyghurs and called out the targeting of racial and ethnic and religious minorities. So he was pretty firm as far as talking about the U.S.-China competition and where the United States stands. However, I think allies and many others in the world who aren't necessarily allies but are looking for the United States for leadership are waiting to see what Biden is actually going to do.
And in mentioning allies, I just wanted to touch on the new partnership between the U.S., United Kingdom, and Australia to counter China's military footprint in the Indo-Pacific. And apparently, France is really not happy about this new alliance. So how will this affect U.S. relations with France?
Well, France is not happy because its bottom line was affected. As I mentioned, you know, it had this big big submarine deal with Australia, which all of a sudden Australia canceled with apparently no prior notice to France. France also sent its foreign minister to the United Nations, not its president. So that was another way of showing its displeasure. But the U.S. really is pivoting toward Asia, and China has been aggressive in some areas like the South China Sea, trying to make some claims on territory there. So the U.S. is sending a very clear message here that Asia and China will be its priorities going forward.
The original deal with France was for diesel-powered submarines to go to Australia. And now the United States and Britain have teamed up to provide nuclear-powered submarines. And there is a little bit of a rub there, I believe, among the world community as far as sending more nuclear technology to yet another country.
Yes, and I understand that President Biden and France's President Macron, they have spoken by phone and plan to meet next month. So we will continue to follow that story. And also, President Biden said that the U.S. has spent more than $15 billion towards the global COVID-19 response and is committed to purchasing 500 million vaccine doses for use by the World Health Organization. However, what is the Biden administration's reaction to critics who say the focus should be more on making sure more Americans are vaccinated?
There's been a lot of contention about that. You know, the head of the World Health Organization said, look, don't start administering boosters in America when a lot of people around the world haven't even had their first shot. And there was a lot of criticism from advocacy groups like Oxfam America, who say that, you know, what they really want is for President Biden to require pharmaceutical companies in the U.S. to share their intellectual property so that COVID vaccines can be made in other countries. And that was not an announcement that President Biden made the other day.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure on the United States to have drug companies and pressure drug companies to share the vaccine technology with poorer countries so that the vaccine can be made there. It doesn't have to be cold shipped, et cetera, to all of these different places where the vaccine is needed. Less than 2% of the people in low-income countries have been vaccinated, and that's where the pressure is on the United States to provide vaccines for the rest of the world. Whether or not the drug companies will share that technology is really an issue that is going to face Biden and have him pressure or not pressure the drug companies to do that. But in the long run, the United States is the maker of the most and appearing the most effective vaccines. So the pressure really is on the United States to help vaccinate the rest of the world.
And also the Biden administration announced that the U.S. will ease restrictions on foreign visitors who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, as some countries in Europe have already loosened rules on vaccinated Americans. So we will continue to follow that. And in looking at climate change, as you all pointed out, Biden said all nations need to bring their highest possible ambitions to the climate summit in November. He talked about investments he's working on with Congress, including for green infrastructure and electric vehicles. Although that agenda currently is in peril on Capitol Hill, how big of an issue is this for the allies of the U.S.?
Well, it's a huge issue because if Washington can't deliver on what it's promised, one of the biggest emitters in the world will continue emitting. And this package that includes some of these climate initiatives appears to be very much in doubt right now because progressives have been pushing for it very hard. And they say that they won't vote on another bipartisan infrastructure package that everybody seems to want until some progress is made on this other $3.5 trillion package that has the global warming initiatives in it.
Steve, with the Democratic Party still divisive between moderates and progressives on the proposed infrastructure bill, President Biden continues to ramp up his engagement with congressional Democrats. So will he be able to get his party on the same page?
That's a really good question, because this is really all in the hands of Democrats. They've got very slim majorities, to be specific, in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And Democrats in both chambers are arguing with one another as to the size and scope of this spending plan. It looks like there already has been an agreement between Republicans and Democrats on one infrastructure spending package that targets roads and bridges and really hard infrastructure that you can touch and see, while Democrats are squabbling over a much larger package that will include more climate initiatives, as well as provide for a much bigger social safety net for Americans. Whether or not the Democrats can get on the same page is really now going to be up to President Biden. He has somewhat stayed out of the fray for the last 6 months, while Democratic leaders from the House and Senate are back and forth as far as how much to spend and what to put in these spending packages. It all comes up against a deadline of the end of the month where the fiscal year ends, and in order to keep the government operating, they've got to pass a spending plan, and that's where most of these progressive initiatives lie, in that spending plan. And moderates in the party are taking a hard line and are afraid that their reelection chances in 2022 will diminish if they spend too much money.
You brought up a really good point, especially concerning the federal government shutdown. As you pointed out, the Democratic-controlled House passed a stopgap bill to keep the government funded at existing levels through December 3rd. So if the bill, which will be difficult to pass in the Senate, if it isn't signed into law by September 30th, do you think it is likely the federal government will shut down?
I think there could be a short shutdown, nothing like the month-long shutdown we had a few years ago. But I think both sides are so dug in that they would be willing to risk a short shutdown, and maybe stocks would plunge, and maybe that would get their attention, and they would pass a continuing resolution, at least, to keep the government going through December. But I think they're willing to risk a short shutdown at this point.
And another flashpoint will come in October, at some point in October, when the United States debt limit is reached and Republicans have told Democrats, you've got the majority, you can raise the debt limit on your own, you don't need any Republican votes. That's going to create yet another moment where President Biden is going to have to get involved in negotiations between Republicans and Democrats and among Democrats in order to raise that debt ceiling so that the United States can pay its bills and not default on trillions of dollars of debt that has already been issued. And that is perhaps an even more serious flashpoint than the government shutdown, although both kind of go hand in hand. The next 10 days between now and the end of the month is really going to tell where the Democrats and where the country is going as far as spending and what they're going to be spending on.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has been steadfast in saying Republicans will not vote to raise the debt limit or suspend the debt limit, even after the Trump Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin had a chat with Mitch McConnell urging him to let this go through. He still says he won't.
Even after, as well, Democrats voted to raise the debt limit when a Republican administration was in charge. The debt limit isn't necessarily about spending in the future. The debt limit is about spending in the past. Everything that has been spent by the United States in the past to run up this incredible tens of trillions of dollars in debt. So it's always been a bipartisan issue, although it has been used for partisan purposes. Right now, there doesn't seem to be a solution yet to figure out how to raise the debt limit. And that's another financial issue that the United States has to deal with politically.
And if this is not resolved, how will this affect the U.S. economy?
Oh, goodness. If the U.S. were to default on its debt, the debt ceiling were not raised or suspended, the stock market would tank, and the U.S. would have to pay a lot more to borrow money. It would have a significant effect on the economy. And the chair of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, was talking about this at his press conference this week and warning Congress to really not to mess around with this, that the debt ceiling really must be raised or suspended.
Okay, there's a lot there that needs to get done in so little time. Well, it's time now for a short break, and when we come back, the plight of Haitians who are crossing the U.S. border from Mexico. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panelists who are joining me via Skype. Nancy Marshall Genzer, senior reporter for Marketplace, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive producer. Well, Nancy, thousands of Haitians joined by other migrants converged upon the border community of Del Rio, Texas, a surge that has overwhelmed local officials and authorities and comes amid a staggering spike in border crossings this year. Given the political and economic instability of Haiti, it really comes as no surprise. However, how is the U.S. handling this surge?
The Biden administration is relying on a policy the Trump administration put into effect during the pandemic that prohibits refugees seeking asylum in the U.S. So that policy is still in place, and that's the policy the Biden administration is using to deport thousands of these Haitians. Some of them are being flown back to Haiti on planes, but Reuters is reporting that the refugees are being sorted. So single adults are being deported, but refugees with families or young children are being allowed to stay in the United States. They're being released with notices to appear in court within 60 days.
It's both a crisis here in the United States and at the border, as well as a crisis for Haiti again. Many of those who are being deported back to Haiti haven't lived in the country for quite a while. Many of them had fled to various different countries in South America during the decades of Haitian crises after crises after crises. And now at least 1,000, probably more, as more flights take place over the next week or so, but going back to a country that has too few resources to handle them, between an earthquake a few weeks ago and the assassination of its president a few months ago, Haiti is a country in crisis itself. And these people who had fled it and lived in other places, tried to come to the United States, are now going back to a country that is even further down the road in crisis mode. And that is as concerning to many as the number of people at the border right now and how the United States is handling that.
Also, Mexico has begun busing and flying Haitian migrants away from the U.S. border, signaling a new level of support for the United States. However, the migrants are asking Mexico to let them peacefully get to the U.S. border. So is this Mexico's goal, getting the Haitian refugees and migrants to the border, or where are they taking them?
They're taking them to another refugee center farther south in Mexico, because a lot of these Haitians came from Central American countries, and they had refugee status in places like South America, in places like Chile or Brazil, and are not seeking refugee status in Mexico. Some of them are being put on buses. Others are being flown farther south in Mexico so they can presumably return to those places where they do have refugee status.
Just wanted to go back to in your comments when you were talking about the Haitians coming from some South American countries. Can the U.S. offer a better future for them?
The United States has historically been a place where refugees have found not just a welcoming home, but also a place where they can thrive and succeed and live the American dream. However, whether or not the political climate right now is open for Haitian refugees or any refugees is a big question after what we had seen over the last 4 years with the very strict immigration policy of the Trump administration. There is a lot of consternation, concern among Democrats that their own president, that Joe Biden, isn't moving fast enough to either overturn or change the policies of the previous administration as far as refugees and immigration and asylum. There was that expectation by many outside of the United States and many Democrats that the policies would be changing and changing quickly. They haven't changed quickly. And recent photos of Haitian migrants being chased by Border Patrol agents on horseback has raised even more concerns among Democrats that the policies of the previous administration have not disappeared, have not changed fast enough under President Joe Biden. So that's yet another issue that Biden is facing within his own party that either he needs to resolve or needs to be smoothed out among the party members.
And President Biden's proposal for a big overhaul of immigration laws is part of that $3.5 trillion package that is now stuck in Congress and doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And as part of that, Biden would grant citizenship to undocumented immigrants like Dreamers. And that's for people who are already in the country. And that is completely stalled.
That's very true. Now, let's move on and get our last topic in. The Taliban rejected as baseless propaganda American concerns that Al-Qaeda or militants linked to the Middle East-based Islamic State terrorist group maintain a presence in the country, despite ISIS-K claiming responsibility for a string of deadly bomb attacks last weekend that targeted Taliban's fighters in eastern Nangarhar province. Where does the U.S. stand, and what is the U.S. doing regarding the situation now in Afghanistan?
Well, I'm not so sure that whether Ronald Reagan's trust but verify quote can be applied here. The Taliban has done little to engender any trust by the United States, as well as among much of the rest of the world. And terrorist groups like ISIS-K take responsibility for bomb attacks in the country, while the Taliban says there's no evidence of terror groups. It doesn't foster much trust in what the Taliban has said.
And the Taliban has a real interest here in trying to reassure the West that Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups will not regain a foothold in Afghanistan, because a lot of Afghanistan's money is tied up in U.S. banks, and Biden has put a hold on it. And right now, that money is not being released to the government in Afghanistan, to the Taliban government.
And the United States has got a little bit of an issue here. Its admission that it mistakenly conducted a drone strike on a suspected ISIS target in the last days of the U.S. foothold in Afghanistan. It turned out to be a car full of civilians, many of which, 7 of the 10 were children that were killed in this attack. So it raises big questions about the effectiveness of what is called the over-the-horizon surveillance of terrorist activity in Afghanistan. That strike took place when the U.S. actually had boots on the ground, intelligence gathering assets on the ground in Afghanistan, and it was a missed target. So now that all of those assets are supposedly out of Afghanistan, there is a question of how good will that intelligence be that is going to be gathered for the over-the-horizon defense against terrorism. It puts the United States in an interesting position as far as how it's going to conduct terrorist surveillance of Afghanistan in the future.
And also, the Taliban asked to speak at the UN General Assembly, and Qatar's ruler, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, says boycotting them would lead to polarization, whereas dialogue could be fruitful. The request to participate in this high-level debate is being considered by a credentials committee whose 9 members include the U.S., China, and Russia. And this is according to a U.N. spokesperson. So if this does happen, that means that world governments would be recognizing the Taliban as Afghanistan's government. Is this likely to happen?
There's a real division here. Countries like China and Russia have already been dealing with the Taliban and probably wouldn't have a problem seating the Taliban's UN representative. The U.S. would, and I think it comes down to who has more clout at the UN and how many other countries the U.S. can get on its side to oppose the Taliban.
It is going to be a measure of the United States' influence in the United Nations as to whether or not the Taliban gets seated, recognized, and is allowed to speak. And if they are, it will tell you a lot about where the U.S. influence is in the United Nations at this point in time.
The future of democracy under the Taliban, and particularly the rights of women and girls, has been a hot topic at the UN. So how will the international community ensure this issue will not be lost in trying to address the other big global crises?
I think for U.S., the leverage is money. Not only does the U.S. have Afghanistan's money tied up in U.S. banks, but also the U.S. has sanctions on various members of the Taliban government, which prevent them from doing things like traveling. So it comes down to money as far as the U.S. is concerned with its leverage.
Can't say that Nancy is wrong. It is about money, and it will be about money and how the United States is going to deal with the Taliban government, if there is a Taliban government, and as it takes root in Afghanistan. But yes, it really is all about money and the billions that the United States has put on hold, as well as billions more that the international community would be willing to give to Afghanistan to fund programs such as education for girls, rather than any of the other things that the Taliban government wants to get funded.
And we'll have to end the show on that note. My thanks to our panelists, Nancy Marshall-Genzer, senior reporter for Marketplace, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive producer. Thank you both for your insights on these very challenging issues. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.